the fight. Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that Peter is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up.
Bob Marley, how could you miss that with Get Up, Stand Up? It is from his 1973 album, Burnin'. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it is Free Your Mind Friday. We continue yesterday's discussion on Donald Trump's calamitous debut as president and indications based on his freewheeling actions this week that the situation likely will remain messy, very messy, for a long, long time. Your thoughts at 888-874-4888 on Free Your Mind Friday. And while you're thinking and drawing your thoughts together, I just want to remind you there is a way to listen to Lead Stories by phone, 712-775-6850. That's 712-775-6850. And you can listen to the last five Lead Stories shows at 701-719-9977. Again, 701-719-9977. The situation, as you can see, is unfolding rapidly in Washington, D.C., and in turn is causing a lot of change going on in other countries as well, not just here in the United States, but we have other countries that are watching in utter consternation what is happening, and this is just the beginning. It's going to get much, much worse. We see that scientists aren't able to get to the president. He's not paying attention to them. As we talked about yesterday, people are beginning to leave the administration, and this has happened at the State Department, where the senior level managers have gone. They tendered their resignations, and they don't want to be part of this administration. The Republicans are having, over this weekend, a retreat in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, and they are basically planning all of their next moves, what they're going to pass, and what they're going to block. We see no indication that the Democrats are doing any such thing, or the independents are doing any such thing, or even third parties. They're not doing any such planning either. So it means that once again, and this is what we've been talking about for months and months and months, the fact that at this precisely the time that we need some kind of reinforcement, some kind of political vehicle that could serve as a protective shield and as a conduit for our feelings and our desires as the people, as they say in Brooklyn, we ain't got nothing. So this is going to be quite a challenge indeed. And it still does not deter us from doing the central thing that we said we need to do, which is to design and devise our own system of survival. We obviously cannot depend on an external mechanism at this time, so we have to do it ourselves. This is exactly what I was trying to convey, to let us come to what I called a point of reckoning, get to a point of reckoning about this political system and what you have to do to devise your own system, and to the extent that we can develop a communal effort, let's try that. But you see that there is no avoiding the fact that we are on our own. Let's start in New Jersey with Bill. You're on the air.
Jeez, how are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you doing?
Good. Love the show. Love you.
Same just here. Because you're here.
Well, I just wanted to get a few thoughts in. It seems like now that Trump has been elected, everything is, Trump is the boogeyman. Everything is bad because of Trump. Everything was great before Trump. And once we get rid of Trump, everything will be good again. And I just wanted to remind people that it was not good before Trump. Barack Obama was not a good president. Barack Obama did not do all this good that people attribute to him. He was not that much different than Trump, other than Barack Obama would attack you from behind, passing legislation on New Year's Eve and these kind of things, and smile in your face. And Trump attacks you from the front. I personally would rather be attacked from the front than attacked from behind. And all the people that think that now everything is bad, but it was great before, like someone called in yesterday and said that Trump is leading a campaign of organized crime and we need to defend like we defend against organized crime. The American government has been organized crime for a long, long time. This is not new. When they annexed an entire sovereign nation like Hawaii in order to further the interests of a few rich people like Dole, that's organized crime. And that took place in the 1890s. So America didn't just become organized crime. It's always been organized crime. And people that think that once Trump is gone, everything will be great again, that's almost like what he's saying, that he wants to make America great again. America was never great unless you were a rich white man, what they called white male landowners, the founding fathers. Unless you were a rich white man, there's never been a time that America was great. And there's not going to be a time that America is great, and it certainly wasn't great under Barack Obama.
Your points are well taken, and they are very much true. And we've maintained that, though, on this program. Barack Obama was, and I've said it from the very beginning, Barack Obama was a creation of...
Absolutely.
He was just a creation and the vehicle for the people who really have power to get their thing done. So we agree there. But I have to ask you, what is the way out as you see it?
Well, the way out is something that you've brought up before, that this system is corrupted and can't be fixed. You have to go around it. You have to build systems of self-government around this system. What you were saying yesterday about, I forgot what the organization was that downgraded our system, saying that it's a flawed democracy now and downgraded it from 19th to 20th.
Right.
When was it not a flawed democracy? I mean, that's the whole reason why you and I both have not voted in over 20 years is because it's a flawed democracy. It never was a good democracy. So systems around this federal government system, what you were talking about organizing on a community level for self-government, Third party, obviously, is one way to go, but I don't think that that will ever be allowed. That will always be crushed, the same way it was crushed this time. So I think you have to go around the system. You have to pull out of the system and say we're governing ourselves, and that begins on small community levels, neighborhoods, neighborhood government, fixing up your own neighborhood, governing your own neighborhood, which is the way humans started government. Government on a grand scale really can't be functional for individuals. That's why humans are basically small tribal. Things are simple enough in small groups, in numbers and also geographically, that just, you know, if you're trying to govern 400 million people over a vast area, I don't think it really can be done effectively where you're actually doing the will of the people. It's just a tool to do the will of, you know, the 1% or the 5% or so. And that's the way it'll always be.
Well, you got
to start.
So you
have to go around it.
You got us started today. I thank you with some very good points. And we'll see how people react to your contribution today, Bill. Thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you.
David from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
I hope you're doing better, and I hope the PRN people are doing well.
And, thank you.
I'm going to start off with a quote from Malcolm X. This is not a democracy, it's a hypocrisy. But let me tell you about the books I wanted to tell you about yesterday before I get to Trump. Alfred.
What if I could ask you, indulge me just this one minute, to kind of condense things so we can get, we have a long queue waiting already.
I plan on condensing. The book is called Psi Healing, PSI Healing, Alfred Stifler, and Imagery and Healing by Gene Echterberg. Because I just recently reread a book I read 10 years ago. It's called The Holographic Universe, Chapter 4, explains it. You ought to read that. Because I pray for you. I hope everybody else does. With in mind, shrinking and melting away the tumors.
We're talking about Trump today. So
yeah, I just wanted to get us to your
point about Trump.
It's not looking good at all, as you already know. Did you know he shut down Twitter on the Parks Department because of his crowd size?
Yeah.
Unbelievable. So that's what we have to look in the future to. I can't see this country surviving with Trump as president.
Oh, why wouldn't you see the country surviving beyond Trump? I mean, he's going to be a difficult, presidency, no question. But I don't believe that it's that fatalistic that we can't survive or won't survive Donald Trump.
He had a private meeting with Paul Ryan, who was totally against him. Then he was for him. I'm assuming it's because of Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. And while he's being inaugurated, he saw a smirk on Paul Ryan's face. I go, oh, I'm going to take that all away from the people, and Trump's going to help. You see my point?
So you don't see any way out? You don't see any credible resistance to the Trump presidency?
Well, it's mainly because of the Social Security, the Medicare, and Medicaid, which a lot of people need badly, and people are actually paying into it, and it's going to be taken away. It's going to be different in some form.
You don't see any possibility at all that he will be resisted?
There'll be some who will resist, but, you know, Washington, they're all corrupt. He'll get his way.
Okay. Well, it's a little dismal, but we shall see. Maybe, you know, maybe you're onto something here. We'll see.
Read those books. Read the book.
Julie from New York, you're on the air. Julie?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. This is my first time calling this year, so I would like to say Happy New Year to you and to the audience at Progressive Radio.
Thank you so much. And the same to you.
Okay. I particularly appreciated your commentary on the Women's March on Monday, especially since you gave a lot of the background information about the organizers. I was not familiar with that, even though I know Linda Sarsour. My attention had been more focused on where I would be going from after the election. And so I had been participating with the independence movement here in New York and how that related to reforming our political system, et cetera. And I hadn't been focused on the Women's March. And I actually thought of it more or less as a pity party for Hillary, which I didn't really want to participate in. But the Green Party, the Green Party, along with Socialist Alternatives, was had a program after the march, and Chris Hedges, Jill Stein, and Shama Sawant were speaking there. So I wanted to participate in that, and I presume so that they had a larger audience, they scheduled it after the Women's March. So on the day of the inauguration, I boycotted that by going to the African American Civil War Museum. Then I attended the march, and then I went to the event Saturday night that was sponsored by Socialist Alternatives, which maybe I'll speak about if I get in next week. But what I wanted to say to add to your commentary was the fact, in addition to the numbers and the diversity. I stayed at the youth hostel, and I'm probably one of your more senior listeners, but that is where I chose to stay. Years ago, I did that for financial reasons, but I found over the years that it's a great education for just being around the people, and I was really, I was blown away by the number of people that were there and the diversity of those people. And while women were sponsoring the march, and that was the main focus, I had overlooked how how Trump had insulted other people. And I just want to mention three quick items about that, my experience. At the youth hostel, there was a group from Vermont of handicapped individuals, and they had come from Vermont, and they were such a loving group of people. And to see young people taking care of the older people that were in wheelchairs, feeding them their meals and preparing their meals, was really very inspiring. And they had come to be a part of the women's movement. And also, because it was a youth hostel, there had been a four-night minimum. So you had to pay for four nights whether you could be there the four nights. So I was there all 4 days. The first night, I lucked out, and I was the only person in the room. Then the second night, there were like five guys. So here I was in this room, in a dormitory room with five guys, which is not totally unusual for anyone that's ever lived in a youth hostel. But, you know, when you're my age, it was a bit unnerving. But I held, you know, they were friendly, and I decided I try to think things through and, you know, go along. But I did express my displeasure to the front desk, but I stopped short of leaving the room because I had, in my opinion, the best spot in the room. But meanwhile, the guys left after the first night. They had probably paid for the first 4 days, even though they weren't going to stay. Meanwhile, the next roommates was a mother and a daughter from Michigan, and the dad came later in the day. There was another young fellow in the room, and as luck would have it, we got to talking with each other, and he's from New York, and then he says he's from the Upper West Side, and he voted for Jill Stein, so we had a lot in common. You know, he's just a friendly sort of person. It's like we had known each other forever. And in addition to this, a good friend of his lives in my building here, and so I knew this friend of his from a child, and I'm sure I had seen him before and just didn't know it, had reason to remember him. But we keep talking and talking, and he tells me that he's actually a radio professional, and he's doing some broadcasting for WBAI. So that was exciting. I go, yes, I didn't know I don't listen to WBAI on a regular basis. I said, but I've been listening to two shows on progressive radio, and they were the two people, Gary Null and Yatrice Reed, were with WBAI. Yeah. And so then he's totally amazed, and we're both amazed. And he said, well, you must know my mom. He said, my mom is Alice. She calls Yatrice all the time. So here I was, and I go, yes, I know your mom.
So you had your own small world experience when you thought it was going to be far more extensive than that. You ended up in a very small part of the world. That's really interesting. What for you, Julie, was the most significant thing from your own personal point of view about the march?
Well, from my personal point of view, I was overwhelmed by the numbers. And when I got, and since I go to a lot of the marches, I was just expecting something like we had with Occupy here, or, you know, when I went over to Democracy Spring. So I was totally unaware and impressed by the diversity and the people that were there. But I also have been focused on how it was the first time for a lot of people. So I had one person actually call me, and then my cousin called back. I went to visit my cousin in Maryland, and she wasn't involved at all. And she says, oh, that's for you people that come from out of town. She's never gone into the city, you know, for marches and this kind of demonstrations, even though she lives in Maryland. So I've been trying to think of ways to follow up so that it's not just a march. And as people have been asking me, I've been using the fact, now I don't know if this is true or not, because I haven't been listening to you. I only learned about you this summer, but based on my notes, on the 25th of January, it was the first time I've heard you give your phone numbers. And I always wondered about that, because Gary always gives his. So because you did that on the 25th, when you did your commentary on the inauguration, I was able to do a text message with your number and Gary's number in the same message, and I actually posted that on Facebook. So I'm trying to spread the word now, because I'd like to, for people that were just newly, that just got engaged because of the election, because, see, had Hillary won, this would have never happened. So I noticed a lot of people that are now wanting to become engaged. My cousin called to say she's going to go to church and she's going to get involved now. But they don't really know what to do. And I can't tell people what to do. I've been engaged in my own way before. So I'm using the opportunity to share, like progressive radio and the independent, some of my educational tools to share with others. So
thank you so much. This is a delightful call. I'm so glad that you went and you were able to give us from your own personal experience what you thought of the march and the good things that have come out of it. Thank you very much, Julie. And also thank you for promoting the program and PRN. Thank you very much for that. Let's go to Massachusetts. Gabriel, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, you three?
I'm hanging in. How about you?
You know, Donald Trump is the gift that keeps on giving.
Well, what do you think, based on this, this is the first week. There's a break, as I'm saying. They're coming back on Monday, I guess. What do you think is happening?
Besides the rumors and the fantastic escalades of conspiracy theories that he's needs to be going under a forensic psychological examination, or the far off conspiracy theory that he may be a clone, I would say that Donald Trump, the Don, as he's called in New York City, is doing a reminiscent of a combination of a Giuliani slash Mona not Hitler, but the Mussolini slash Constantine of the old Dark Ages kind of stage vaudeville performance. And he's
been called out. Do you expect it to get any better or any worse Which of the two?
This is a graphic novel that's going to unfold. And within the graphic novel, you're going to have him having very passionate beliefs that he can actually maintain the true integrity of the United States, being of a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant direction, with their subculture of ethnic groups placed in line, in tow. And part of that subculture is white females, black women, ethnic Latino women, and of course down the line to African men, Mexicans, all who are able and who are worthy enough in his mind to remain in this country to become more consumer slaves, I believe. And the Department of, as you know, the Department of Justice or the State Department resigned, as you stated yesterday, for a good reason, because this is a totally attempt of the combination of corporate America, fascist America, a coup d'etat of the government, where they don't want to have the Federal Reserve, they don't want to have to fall and talk to the Supreme Court, they don't want to talk to the Senate or the Congress to move their agenda. And you will see, like Madeleine Albright, you will see those who are the pillars of such stature in government going against this man one by one, and the media won't be able to stop it. The media won't be able to be controlled. And eventually he'll be some scandalous affair or some sexual harassment or sexual assault case will come into the fold, and perhaps he'll be chastised or embarrassed to resign, or he may have a 4 years of his own brand of governing.
So with this picture that you have painted here, what does a person do? How are you situating yourself to cope with this administration?
You know, that's a very interesting question. I'm glad you asked that. Imagine so that you're in a very diverse working environment, marketing, telecommunication, banking, advertising, media, TV, take your pick, and you see your female, not feminazis, not sort of like slanted towards the women's liberation movement, but it's just normal women just stopping what they're doing at the Xerox computer, and just saying they had enough. And these women, white, black, they had enough. And then imagine, if you will, hey, you know what? There's a great radio station, or there's a great program called PRN and WBAI, and there's Amy Goodman, and there's ZeroHedge.com and Brass Check, and you can look at all these cool things and the Intercept. How about checking them out and put all that energy that was placed into the Women's March into these different platforms and get involved? This would never be so if we had a complacent, docile, happy, euphoric Hillary Clinton presidency. It would not have gained this galvanizing effort to embolden the polarities, the emboldened polarities of the extreme white male misogynist who sees victory, the extreme polarity of white women working with diverse cultures to understand that this is their, as Cornel West says, their Negro wake-up call.
Thank you for calling and contributing. Lots to think about. Let's see if people react to what you just offered. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Jose from Rosedale, you're on the air.
Greetings, my professor.
Hello there. How are you, Jose?
Fine. And you?
I'm hanging in. I'm good.
Well, I haven't spoken to you since the new year began, and I want to send my love and my good wishes for you and the PRN crew and all your listeners. I send, I wish you all happiness, good health, great prosperity, and an abundance of consciousness for the new year.
Well, thank you. That's
now,
a lot. I'll take
thank
it.
Thank you. I have two topics here that I hope I can just, I want to abbreviate them, in, you know, get them, make it as tight as I can, because I'd like, really love to have your comment on it. You promised me once that you were going to do a comprehensive story on one of them, which is the Crownites affair, and I don't know if I missed it, because I've been in, I've not been in class as often as I should. But I just want to touch base on this. Last night I went to a meeting on Empire Boulevard, and the meeting was supposed to be about the fate of the if not the last piece, it is certainly the largest parcel of city-owned property, well, the people-owned property. It's the Bedford Armory, a couple of blocks up from Medgar Evers College.
Right.
Now, the interlopers and those within the community, well, that's sitting right there on a fault line. And the interlopers and the big money people, the deep pocket people, want to control, as always, the outcome of that piece of real estate. Now,
well,
the community.
Let's provide some background here. The issue is the Bedford Armory. It's a huge parcel of land, and it's a huge armory.
Yes.
That has been used in recent years for any number of things, including storage of emergency supplies and as a station for the National Guard and that kind of use. And from time to time, it also could be rented out for community affairs, like flea markets and that kind of thing.
Thank you, my professor. That's why I love you so much, because you have a way of just polishing out my rough edges. No.
No, but you have to give, because people are outside of the New York City area may need to know what the background is so that they can appreciate what it is you're commenting on. So in recent months in particular, there's been a pretty strenuous effort to sell the property.
Yes.
This is government property, to sell it to a private developer for the rebuilding of luxury homes, luxury apartments.
Yes.
And there is great suspicion that a lot of underhanded dealing went on there to acquire the property, and also that the with that property being refurbished and rebuilt and reconstructed to accommodate luxury, I always called it luxury homes, luxury apartments, it would then further exacerbate the gentrification of this
community.
The
removal of all people.
And because it also is close to the new arena and the railway hub that has been built. So go ahead from there.
Yes. So now, who we have negotiating on our behalf is the usual quisling politicians in our community and a couple of activists. Some have good intentions, but they are susceptible to certain, you know, the usual, how should I put it? The weakness of the wealth of the powerful. And so on the other side, we have the politicians, the other politicians, the mayors and so forth, and the interlopers, those with big money, the developers, real estate developers and so forth, and the lawyers and so forth. They even have our local politicians in their pockets also. So that have gone against them. I went to this meeting, but it was canceled. I didn't know it was canceled, and till I got there, they told me that it was canceled, and they said there's no rescheduling. They don't know when it will be rescheduled. And I am of the opinion that the die is already cast. The folks who know what they're going to do there already know. When we, the little people in the street, know about it, it is it's already a done deal. Right? So that is one topic I just want to touch on, and I hope that in the coming weeks or so, you will find it possible to delve more deeply into it so we can try to unmask this thing and see where we go with it. All right? And the other thing I would like to touch on is that I went on Wednesday, I went to a forum at the Fordham University campus, one of the campuses in the city. And the discussion was about the America's shocking history of eugenics. It is titled The State of Eugenics. It is going to air on PBS, I think, on January 29th. Right? And they did a documentary showing you what this country has done to African people. And a few whites, even though they tried to feature a few whites in the documentary, but we know that the overwhelming number of people that was affected by this eugenics movement was African people. And I spoke to the producer of the film was there, and she said they had started a movement to give reparation to some of the living victims of the eugenics movement. And it was a hard struggle, but finally they were able to do it. They allotted, I think, $20,000 per victim, right? And I think so far it's only two states, North Carolina and I think Virginia, that has passed a law that the surviving victims should be compensated to the tune of, I think North Carolina has said 20,000. I don't know what Virginia has allocated. And so they have the living victims there, and they told the stories of the horrors that they have been through. And it was state and federal funded type of cruelty and evil that was meted out to African people in this country. And the producer of the film, someone asked her about what is happening today for blacks and so on and so forth. And she's saying that to prevent those type of events from happening in the future, we have to be constantly vigilant. So I asked her, when you put vigilance up against the mighty power of the state and federal, most cases, most times, who do you think will come out the winner? And she says, most times the states do come out the winner. I said to her, right now, we have all the makings of those type of atrocities coming back full scale on our people. Because as we are standing here today, many of those things are still happening to our people in different forms. And I told her that if this we have a scenario right now where we have an administration, based upon what he has said and based upon the people that he has surrounding him, those things, those evils can easily revisit our people again. And there will be no one here standing up for the rights of African people and people of color. Because I said, it happened in Germany to Europeans. Europeans did it to Europeans. And by the way, you forget to mention the countless millions of Africans and other people of color that was destroyed in that eugenics experiment of Hitler and his group of people. I said, we have nobody to advocate and to vindicate us. I said, we have no power to stand up to the might of the state. So What do we do? I said, we can come together as a people and try to fight all these things. But I said, again, the mighty power and the arm of the state is so powerful that even right now, reporters are quivering in their shoes to confront this man and his evil plans for people, certain people in this country. And so, my professor, I would just love to have your comment and see where we go from there. I respect how you able to put things in this proper perspective and so forth. And I'm still a student of yours. I'm not graduated yet.
But I'm constantly studying
under you.
Thanks so much for calling in, and great to hear from you for the new year. This issue of eugenics goes way, way back. If you read the biography of Thomas Jefferson.
Yes.
There's a very interesting part by Jane Brodie. There's a very interesting part of that book in which Thomas Jefferson is described as spending an extraordinarily huge amount of time developing a mathematical formula to explain a particular premise. This came at one of his parties at his house, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
A guest of his house looked around and saw slaves that didn't look like the slaves he had or that he had observed before.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked Thomas Jefferson, how come your slaves look different? Well, of course, we know how it came to be different. Thomas Jefferson, and as many of the plantation owners did, had his way with the women on the plantation, and they produced very different-looking slaves.
Mm-hmm.
He was a pederast. He was a child rapist. And he also was a deadbeat dad. I think he was the nation's first deadbeat, official presidential deadbeat dad.
Yes.
But in any event, he developed this formula to answer the question. And the question, he interpreted it as, when does a black person become white?
Mm.
What will have to happen? What is the mathematical formula to get rid of blackness? It takes four pages, that formula that he developed, and he developed this mathematical formula to show that with careful and selective breeding, it is possible to rid the world of blackness and transform black people into white people.
Mm.
Now, so that's eugenics right there.
Mm.
And it goes way, way earlier than people would imagine in the United States. Of course, we know of all the other experiments that were done for all kinds of reasons to produce the perfect Aryan race.
Mm-hmm.
This was desirable, but it was desirable from the beginning in the United States. The desirable goal was to create like a two-level society where you have slaves and you have the elite.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, they were working Thomas Jefferson, the president.
Mm-hmm.
So the White House is not alien to these kinds of concepts. Race-based concepts to achieve racial perfection and racial superiority, because it was, after all, a white supremacist system.
Yes.
So if you were running short, or if it seems as if you were running short of whites, Thomas Jefferson created a formula to produce more whites. This is what's happening. I mean, brought forward to today, you could see the application of something like that, because in 2032, by then, the United States would be a majority non-white country. Mm-hmm. That's according to the Bureau of the Census. In fact, more than 11% of the country has already tilted on that racial line. Mm-hmm. Whites will become the official minority of the United States. This is the undercoating of the tidal wave of support that Donald Trump recognized and is speaking to and had spoken to become this popular president. And I use popular in quotes. So we have eugenics, an obsession with eugenics, starting in a documented form as early as Thomas Jefferson's era. I mean, a scientific, purposeful approach to produce a master race.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not new.
Yeah.
It's not new here. Native Americans also, in their own way, served as the first subjects, but overwhelmingly the African American was the obsession.
Mm-hmm.
How to deracinate people of African descent and mm-hmm. to make them at least physically white.
Yes.
If we look today at the, you know, you look today at how many black women are just embracing the aspects and attributes, the physical attributes, you know, the blonde hair, the whatnot, and the whites are doing the exact opposite. They want to look black.
Yes.
You see some really interesting switches going on culturally and racially, but mm-hmm. it will eventually become a stark divide. You either are black or white.
Yes.
And that's where they were working toward in Jefferson's day. He was working toward a society where you're either one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And we could manufacture the other if we want to. You know, that's, imagine that. Who would have thought that?
Yes.
But so, like I said, this is a great obsession. Race is a major obsession, even though it is a not a biological construct at all.
Mm-hmm.
It is completely made up, this notion of race. You are who you are. But mm-hmm. It is a pseudo scientific way to explain an obsession with supremacy based mm-hmm. on skin color in our United States. So my advice there is simply to look at it as the latest manifestation
mm-hmm.
of this business of maintaining racial dominance, which is white supremacy.
Yes.
And it was not from the beginning something that they believed should be left to chance. You know, the slave owners strictly regulated, you know, they themselves, white men could have access to the slaves,
yes,
male or female, as they wished. But they strictly regulated the reproduction and the purity of reproduction. They were very, very obsessed with this.
And I think Donald Trump is going to unify the both parties into one. I think he's going to do that.
Well, we shall see. It's all a matter, you know, I'm worrying less about Donald Trump because he has already made clear who he is and what he wants to do.
Sure.
He's made that clear. So we shouldn't be so surprised where this thing is going.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, what are we doing? How are we fixing to deal with what's coming down the pike?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we need to be concentrating on.
Yes.
He's already shown himself, and as the saying goes, when somebody shows you who they are, believe them and believe them the first time.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so we got the message a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
We got this message a year and perhaps even more than that ago.
Yes.
What we haven't done in the time that has elapsed is construct a healthy alternative for ourselves. Mm-hmm. How will we survive? Because that's the number one imperative.
Yes.
That's it. So great to talk with you today, and thank you for offering your analysis of what's going on in Crown Heights. Mm-hmm. Still undergoing changes, but, you know, it's like settlements being built in Palestine.
Yes,
it's the same process.
Yes.
We have our Palestinian problem right there in Brooklyn, and it's been there for quite a few years. And now it is almost completely in effect. Mm-hmm. We have a couple of patches here and there, a few brownstones and a few multi-unit buildings that are still hanging in there. But mm-hmm. it's only a matter of time before they fall prey to development, unquote. Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling in. Joe from Florida, you are on the air and you have a little bit of time.
Hey, somebody said they love your show. I'll go one step further. Platonically speaking, I love you, Patrice. You are so insightful, and I'm not a flatterer, believe me, but I really appreciate you and your thoughts, okay?
So I appreciate you too. I appreciate the audience. They keep me going. It's an amazing thing.
I'm a bad white guy, okay? Now, I grew up in a very... Okay, I thought you'd like that. I grew up in North Jersey, in a very integrated community. It was back then. I don't know what's going on today. I've been out of there for 40 years. And I am fortunate that I don't see things the way most people do. I'm sort of like in denial because I don't have a problem with anybody, regardless of their race, creed, or color, or whatever else. And so I've gone through life that way. My parents weren't bigots. My siblings aren't racists or bigots, and neither are my three children. And I hope their children remain that. So I just wanted to say that because I'm very upset about what the racism in this country. It's terrible. Anyway, having said that, you said early in the show that you expect things to remain messy. And I wonder how anyone could think otherwise. It's just not going to happen. It's just going to, regardless of whether Trump or Clinton got in there, things are going to, nothing's going to, the average person is hurting more and more every day. And nothing Trump nor Clinton would do anything about it. But you talked about I think a lot of things I could cover, but one more thing I want to say is that you talked about the peace, the Women's March last Monday or whatever it was.
Saturday.
Yes. Well, no, but you talked about it Monday, I believe.
Oh, Monday. Yes, I spoke about it Monday.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I just wanted to say that this is the way I take everything. The whole social and economic and whatever issues you could come up with are the result of the bulk of the people who have a fixation with a party, whether it be Democrat or Republican. And I would bet that a significant number of Democrats and or Republicans would vote for Charles Manson if he were put on any one of their tickets, locally from a dog catcher all the way to the President of the United States. That's how I know people. I know a lot of people, and they are totally fixed on their party, regardless of who they'd run. And so, we're presented with Trump and Clinton, and we have no choice.
Precisely. I mean, it was a really bad scenario, no matter how you took it, between Trump and Clinton. It would have been horrible no matter who you chose. But here's the thing. It's been a while since we've seen a president. So I did a program called The Politics of Vengeance. And this is what it is. We have very unstable people in public life with an awesome amount of power. And they may look normal and everything until you see the sad undergirding of what they bring to the office. These are people who are in need of immediate and deep counseling. They're not well. I'm serious about that.
You say that is, I know you're serious, and you're correct, I think. I mean, I agree with you.
But look what they're doing. See, this is the thing. Supposedly in this democracy, our will to either rev up the throttle or apply the brake should at least be part of the factor of how the government works. And it doesn't work that way. You get the feeling that Donald Trump, this is his personal toy for the moment. And we are just observing disaster getting nearer and nearer to us without the ability to stop it, to stop him.
Let me ask you this. Do you think there are people in this country who could become the president? Let's say it this way. If they were the president of the United States, that they would act for the benefit of the public and do and be a good person?
I think they would. I think there are people who certainly could be found.
Where are they? And why don't they come to the surface? Where are they?
Because this system is avaricious. This system will tear you up. This system is ruled by a clandestine group of exceedingly wealthy people and the military and the intelligence community. And, you know, we have a documented history of people who meant to do the right thing, who wanted to do the right thing, also being killed. So it is not as benign a system as we would like to think it is at all. Oh, it's time for us to go. We have to wrap up.
I know that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe. And we should talk again soon because you really didn't have as much time as you needed to stretch out and give us the full set of ideas that you wanted to present today. Well, that brings us to the end of the program. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Dr. Jack Rasmus with Alternative Visions. And there's always something to learn from Dr. Jack. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you think about the program. And it's the weekend. Surround yourselves with people who bring positive dimension to your life. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.
Don't give up the fight.
Don't give it up. Don't give it up.
Get up, stand up.
Get up, stand up.
Stand up.